WBOB.
The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Great to have you with us today. The president getting back from Helsinki. The press in full jacket meltdown. The fake newsers going crazy. Well, what are they upset with? Well, they're allied now with the neocons and the warmongers because the fake newsers hate Trump and the neocons. Well, they want bombs and missiles. And the president, delivering on another promise, just wants a peaceful resolution to the conflicts with one of our arch enemies that also has a stockpile of nuclear weapons. Makes no sense. Joining us now to break all this down, Corey Lewandowski. Corey is the author of the best book on the campaign, Let Trump Be Trump. You can buy it, go to Amazon or your favorite bookstore, wherever that may be. Let Trump Be Trump by Corey Lewandowski. Buy it by today. Great summer read. And he was also the campaign manager for the Donald Trump for President campaign, engineering the greatest nomination underdog win in the history of U.S. politics. And he's with us now. And by the way, the next 3 days we'll be broadcasting from Corey Lewandowski studio headquarters, our D.C. studio. Hey, Corey, great to have you.
Hey, John, how are you?
I tell you, Corey, the press, the fake newsers, the legacy media in full jacket meltdown over the president's press conference in Helsinki. What's Corey Lewandowski's take?
Well, John, this is not surprising to me. You've seen people who have wanted to take this president down long before he even became the president, that has never wanted to give him credit. And look, I happened to write an op-ed on this very topic that was posted in the Hill newspaper. And what I said, and there is a historical perspective to this, is we are going to look back and we're going to look at the relationship that this president is putting together with Vladimir Putin, and we will put it on par with the relationship that Richard Nixon had with China and that Ronald Reagan had with the former Soviet Union, of rebuilding a relationship that has really been deteriorating over the last 20 years. The Soviet Union was a superpower. Russia is a superpower today. They are a significant holder of nuclear weapons. And what this president said was, we're going to talk about nuclear proliferation, the denuclearization of our countries, but we have to have a relationship. And it is widely known that we have the worst relationship between the United States and Russia since the Cold War, and that needs to change.
Now, I just have to tell you this, Corey, and I really look at these things, I guess, a little bit differently because I'm not part of, I don't have the agenda that some of the legacy media has. And we said all day Monday for 4 hours, we said no matter what Trump does at this press conference, the legacy fake newsers are going to blast him. It doesn't matter what he says. It's like just Peyton cuss insert here or cut and paste. But I saw the press conference live in a studio yesterday waiting to go on TV. And I got on with a panel as soon as it was over. I thought his press conference was great. I was shocked when I started getting this feedback back.
Well, yeah, but John, you have to remember, look at this. This is amazing. I listened to the so-called experts, the national security experts who put us in this position in the first place, the Clappers of the world, the Brennans of the world, right? The individuals who under their watch, John, had Russian meddling in our system that they did nothing about. This took place under the Obama administration, and they did nothing about it. And what they said was, the president should not be meeting with Vladimir Putin one-on-one. What is he hiding, right? If he would have brought a team in, they would have said, Donald Trump is not capable of meeting with Vladimir Putin one-on-one. It doesn't matter what took place. They have to find a negative narrative because they hate this president more than they love their country, John. And what we all want, what every American should want, is to make sure that we continue to be the world dominant power, the greatest superpower the world has ever seen. We are in a position of strength, and this president negotiates from a position of strength. But the cable news networks, from the second he finished the press conference till, you know, today, their heads are exploding. I saw that CNN put out a statement that said the former National Security Council spokesman canceled because he couldn't defend Donald Trump, and he had to correct them and said, no, I canceled because I knew you were going to use me and me coming on to be attacking Donald Trump, and I do nothing but support his agenda. That's what the media has continued to do. The American people are so smart. They see right through this. They know what the fake news is, and they go and they understand when they wake up every day, they are better off today than they were 2 years ago, and that's why Donald Trump is continuing to win.
And that's why he's going to win again. Who was that they had? Was that General McMaster?
No, it was Michael Anton.
Michael Anton.
They wanted to have on the former national security spokesman.
CNN, got it.
And he said he wasn't going to go on. And then they put out a statement, CNN did, saying he canceled because he couldn't defend Trump's statements at the press conference. And he had to write a lengthy response. So that's absolutely not true.
Right.
That's not what happened. And he has to clarify. The problem is these outlets have large microphones. And unless you're the president, it's very difficult to fight back against the false narratives that they put out against people.
Well, and here's the thing. What was the objective of this meeting? Here's my question that I asked on TV yesterday. What was the objective of this meeting and the summit, right? What was the president's objective? It certainly wasn't to go meet and have fun, right? So what was his objective? Well, his objective was to restart a relationship, get a dialogue going, get some common ground and go from there, right? That was the objective. That objective was met with a resounding success yesterday. So what is the problem with these people?
Look, the problem is they don't want to see two world leaders having a conversation. And look, I understand it. Russia has been an adversary of ours for a long time. But we also have to understand, without the help of Russia and China, we don't have any leverage as it relates to North Korea and the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which in my mind, John, I'll tell you, global warming is not the number one problem facing our world. The denuclearization of North Korea is much more important for global survival than global warming. And if we don't have help, and even the president's harshest critics have to admit, if we don't have help from Russia and from China, we have no leverage over North Korea and Kim Jong-un. And what we have seen is since the president has put on a campaign of maximum pressure, we have seen no additional testing, no additional nuclear weapons coming out of there, no nuclear weapons coming out of there, no additional missile launches. That can only be done, unfortunately, because of the global climate, with the help of Russia and with the help of China. And we also have to find ways where we can have a symbiotic relationship where we can work with Russia to destroy ISIS. That is a good thing for the world, not a bad thing. So there are absolutely ways and reasons why we have to have a better relationship with Russia. They are clearly adversaries to us. They clearly have a different way of life. And if we think for 1 second that the United States doesn't engage in being involved in foreign elections, then we are as naive as anybody else. And the bottom line is this: we have to find ways where two superpowers can work together for the betterment of the world. And I've just outlined two of those examples.
Well, look, you're absolutely right. There are so many things that we can work on together. But look, what you've got right now, you saw the statement yesterday from Senator John McCain, and this is like the devil's bargain we've got going on now, Corey, between the neocons and the warmongers and the Republican Party, the never Trumpers that just hate Trump. They've got to create bogeymen. Now it's Russia. You know, they can't have China as the enemy because they want to defend them over the tariffs. So they have to find someone else. So what do they do? Now we're back to the Russian Federation and what they did in Crimea. And look, we can't cop the world, right? But the statement by John McCain yesterday, I thought was outrageous based on the knowledge that he has. I mean, they're of no national threat to us right now. What the president is simply attempting to do is create a platform for negotiation going forward. I mean, isn't that what Democrats want? Don't they want peace and diplomacy?
I don't know what they want anymore, John, is the problem. I don't think they know what they want. Look, the new leader, in my opinion, of the Democratic Party, this woman who beat Crowley in New York, right, was asked a series of foreign policy questions who, by the way, John, she happened to go and get a degree in foreign policy from Boston University, I think. And when they started asking her drilled down questions about foreign policy, mind you, she is now the leader of the Democratic Party, right? She is mm-hmm. the face of the party, the 28-year-old who has taken on the Titan. And they ask her a simple question about Israel, and she laughs half-jokingly and says, well, I'm not an expert on foreign policy matters, right? She is the leader of the Democratic Party as far as I'm concerned. She is where the Democratic Party is going. She is saying that Palestine, you know, and Israel, she can't even delineate between the two of them and what's going on there. The Democrats have no foreign policy. All they have is an obstructionist agenda, which they have tried to continue on this president for the last 2 years. That obstructionist agenda includes stopping Judge Kavanaugh from becoming a Supreme Court justice. They attempted to stop Neil Gorsuch. They have every single one in lockstep voted against the president's tax cuts to give middle-class working families tax relief. They have tried to stop deregulation of the government. They have tried to stop this agenda at every single turn, but the economy is booming. The safety and security of our country is better than ever because of peace through strength. The members of our military have received a pay raise for the first time in almost a decade. And the Democrats, all they want to do is stop and be obstacles. So they have no agenda. So when you ask what their foreign policy agenda is, they have no domestic agenda. They have no foreign policy agenda other than being obstacles. And that's why they're not going to be successful come November.
You're on the John Fredericks Radio Network, Trucking the Truth Across America. We're live, coming to you live in Washington, D.C. I'm with Corey Lewandowski, and he is the former campaign manager for the Trump for President campaign. He's also a senior advisor now with
It's the Great America Committee. It's we call it GAC, but it's the Great America Committee. It's the vice president's political action committee. It's the hard dollar PAC, where we are raising money for candidates who are supporting the Trump-Pence agenda. That's hard money, no corporate contributions. They're individuals. We take that money and we turn it around and we give it to candidates or incumbents who are running for office in November, whether they are governors, senators, or congressmen. We're focused on those three particular types of races. And we have turned over hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to make sure that we keep the House, we expand our majorities in the Senate, and we hold on to our Republican governors around the country.
All right, senior advisor for the Vice President's Great America Committee, Political Action Committee. And don't forget also, it's a great summer read. It's the best book you're going to buy about the Trump campaign, which is Corey's book, Let Trump Be Trump by Corey Lewandowski. You go to Amazon, go to your favorite bookstore, get it as a gift, get it for yourself, buy two, buy three. But buy them because it is a great book and a lot of fun. I read it two times. Both times I laughed. Second time was even better because I could anticipate some of this stuff. But you definitely want to buy that Let Trump Be Trump. Now, Corey, in your position with the Great America Committee, you've traveled around the country with the vice president, helping out various candidates, raising money. Give us your prognostication right now for the fall, the midterms. What do you see happening, Corey?
You know, if the election were held today, and I can tell you this, the political climate in this country is getting better every day for the Republicans because more and more people are going back to work and they see what this economy is doing. If the election were held today, I believe the Republicans pick up a net gain of three U.S. Senate seats, which would take their majority from 51-49 to 54-46. Mm-hmm. That would be very helpful in moving the president's agenda forward. And I also believe, well, I think the Republicans will lose a couple House seats, seats where the president carried in his presidential election to help people get elected. I think by and large, the Republicans are going to hold the House of Representatives right now, which would be historic because that almost never happens. And the president and the vice president, I can tell you this, they have a very aggressive schedule to be out on the road. I know the vice president was in Chicago last week. He's going, I think, to Tennessee on the 21st coming up. He's got a trip to St. Louis and Denver and Philadelphia and North Dakota and West Virginia, and they are just on the road all over the country helping candidates, raising money for them. You know, and you look at what they've been able to do from a fundraising perspective, historic numbers, giving that money away to make sure the Trump-Pence agenda stays in place, and they're going to be successful come November.
Okay, let's just talk very quickly about some of the races I think the Republicans are going to pick up. I'm just going to give you the state and the incumbent and just get a quick comment on it. And how do you think the Republicans can win? Montana, John Tester.
John Tester loses. We've got a great candidate. Rosendale's going to win that seat out there. Tester talks one way in Montana, votes a different way in Washington. The people of Montana are going to send John Tester home.
In Missouri, Air Claire McCaskill.
Claire McCaskill is a very tough campaigner. She's going to have $25 million. We've recruited the absolute best candidate in Josh Hawley. He is going to win that race. It's going to be a nail-biter. But this is a year where Republicans are going to dominate, and the Democrats are going to end up leaving Claire McCaskill behind. Josh Hawley is going to be the next U.S. Senator from Missouri.
In Florida, Scott Bill Nelson.
I'll tell you what, you know, this is a race that people have said is the matchup of the Titans. I don't think so. I think Bill Nelson is past his prime. I think Governor Scott is exceptionally popular. He is going to win that race by 6 points, and it's going to surprise a lot of people when Bill Nelson doesn't get the resources he's going to need from the Democratic Committee to survive.
Heidi Heitkamp, North Dakota.
I think Congressman Kramer is going to win that seat as well. Heidi votes with the president sometimes, and sometimes she doesn't, and that's a state where the president dominated that reelection. Congressman Kramer will be calling him Senator Kramer after November.
Joe Manchin, West Virginia.
Very difficult race. I think Senator Manchin is extremely popular in his state, a former two-term governor, but that is a state where the people have supported the president. He won by over 40% there. If anybody can win there, Morrissey has a chance, and he's going to do it only with the help of Donald Trump and Michael Pence. That's going to be a tough, tough race, but there is a chance for a pickup there.
Donnelly, Indiana.
That is a seat that we are going to win. Braun is going to become the next senator from Indiana, and Donnelly goes home.
Nevada.
Dean Heller is working hard. We were just out there. The president flew out there last month. I traveled with him. Tough race. I like our chances in Nevada. And again, with the help of the president, the vice president, Dean Heller is going to hang on to that seat.
All right. What's your biggest seat at risk?
Let me tell you the seat that I think we have the most opportunity in, John. And I know you're going to laugh at me probably. The state of New Jersey, right?
Get out of here.
Listen, Bob Menendez's hard reelect number right now is 24%. 24% when you say, should Bob Menendez be reelected, the people of New Jersey say yes. We have a self-funding candidate who I think just put $15 million into that race. We have seen Republicans win there before with people like Chris Christie. We've seen John Corzine lose that seat in the past. Bob Menendez, in my opinion, is the most endangered Democrat incumbent in the country right now that no one is paying attention to. And if things break our way, we're going to win a New Jersey Senate seat for the first time in a long time.
Is your candidate there somebody that's savvy? You think you can pull it off?
Smart, former business executive, has financial resources. And it's, look, don't forget, Bob Menendez was indicted and prosecuted by the Obama administration for fraud. Not exactly a badge of honor in the state of New Jersey when your own president is indicting you and charging you with fraud in New Jersey. And that's what the ads say, right? The ads they're running right now is saying that the Obama administration prosecuted Menendez. They're the ones who indicted him. He's in big trouble in that state, and no one's paid attention. Look, the New Jersey Democrats are very smart. My guess is they will find a way to get Bob Menendez off that ballot before Election Day comes because they know he can't win. But if they don't, you may see the biggest upset of the night, which is a new Republican U.S. senator from New Jersey.
All right, we're going to be watching that one. I remember New Jersey Democrats did that one other time. I think the governor was Jim Florio, and he was in some scandal. He was running for re-election. If my memory serves me, it was Jim Florio, and somehow they got him off the ballot and put somebody else on who got beat anyway. But I wouldn't be surprised if the New Jersey Democrats did that. I've got another minute. Anything else, any other race you see out there that we ought to be watching?
Look, I think, you know, another race you want to watch is obviously the race in Arizona. You've got Jeff Flake retiring. You've got three Republicans who are vying for that seat. It is a late primary. It doesn't happen until the end of August. And then you've got one Democratic candidate who is a member of Congress who's running for that seat. That's going to be a competitive seat. It's going to be a very competitive seat. It's a place where Republicans need to be on the offense. And right after that primary, and we know who our Republican nominee is going to be, I'm sure President Trump, Vice President Pence are going to be down there campaigning to make sure we keep that in our hands. But that's a race that people want to pay attention to, because right now the Democrats have some momentum being unified where the, mm-hmm. where the Republicans are still divided.
Well, McSally has the lead, but she was a never-Trumper. Kelly Ward, who was pretty far behind her in the polls, I think just got $500,000 in her PAC from the Mercers. So that's going to help her a little bit. But, you know, I've had Kelly Ward on my show enough times. I don't see her winning that race. I know you can't comment on primaries, but I think McSally is going to be the nominee, and we'll see how that plays out. So, look, I mean, if you know, you predicted three pickups, but if you win, you got Montana, Missouri, Florida, North Dakota, West Virginia, Indiana, if you were able to hold Nevada and Arizona and pick New Jersey up, that's plus seven.
It is plus seven. And look, I think the West Virginia race, Joe Manchin is a very, very good candidate. He's going to be hard to beat, but we have an opportunity because of how good of an environment that is for the president and his agenda, right? Claire McCaskill is going to be hard to beat because she's got $25 million.
Right.
She runs hard. She is a tenacious campaigner. But we've got the best candidate we could find in Josh Hawley. So, you know, those are two races where we have to make sure we go on the offense. And then if you look at New Jersey, right, three races where we can be on the offense going after these guys. And then I think Kramer's going to win in North Dakota. I think Tester gets sent home. I really do. I think Braun is a done deal in Indiana. He's going to win that seat in big margins against Donnelly. And I think Rick Scott is going to make that race not as tight as people hope it was going to be.
I agree
with that. We recruited the best candidate. Governor Scott is fantastic. He's done an amazing job in Florida. And, by the way, it also helps that he's a self-funder. And, you know, a lot of people like that, too. So keep your eye out in the U.S. Senate. We could see some real margins moving forward.
All right. Corey Lewandowski, thanks for being with us. Corey, great rundown. I really appreciate it. So helpful for all of us because we know that you're inside, you're seeing everything, you're out in these various states, and you're talking to people as you always do. So thanks for sharing that with us, and thanks for being with us. Corey Lewandowski, buy his book, Let Trump Be Trump. It's a great summer read, Let Trump Be Trump by Corey Lewandowski and Dave Bossy. Go to Amazon.com or go to your favorite bookstore, Let Trump Be Trump.
Yeah. You're listening to the John Frederick Show. Common sense for the Commonwealth. On great radio stations across Virginia and online anytime at thejohnfrederickshow.com.
With SRN News, I'm Ron DeRockstra. A rare nor'easter expected to hit New York City and the tri-state area tonight, with 1 to 2 inches of rain expected, along with isolated flooding and thunderstorms possible. Meteorologists are forecasting wind gusts up to 40 miles an hour as low-pressure system moves up the East Coast. The storm could pass by late Sunday morning, leaving behind temperatures in the low 80s, but with high humidity. Vice President Mike Pence headlining a rally in Georgia today in support of Secretary of State Brian Kemp's bid for governor. The event in Macon comes just 3 days before Kemp's runoff against fellow Republican Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle Tuesday. President Trump waded into the race last week, tweeting, quote, his full and total endorsement for Kemp, pointing to Kemp's strong position on illegal immigration. The winner faces Democrat Stacey Adams in November. This is SRN News.
Download WBOB's mobile app for free from your app store. Powered by Duval County Judicial Candidate Kimberly Sadler.
Here's some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for a health care plan, or more importantly, if you signed up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare. MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing program. It's been around for 25 years. They have hundreds of thousands of members all across the country. And get this, over the years, MediShare members have shared more than $2.5 billion of each other's medical bills. Best of all, you could save a lot of money with MediShare. The typical savings for a family is about $500 a month. Your savings may be less or more, but think about what you could do with that extra money every month. So if you think you're stuck with a high-cost health plan that doesn't have much to offer, think again. You can join MediShare anytime, so call them today and check it out. Here's the number to find out more. There's no pressure. They're super easy to talk to. 877-64-BIBLE. That's 877-64-BIBLE. 877-64-BIBLE.
Z, the founder of the original Tunis restaurant, and Robert Rucab, owner of St. John's Seafood Restaurant, have teamed up. The result is a new national chain called Tip Top Chicken and Shrimp. Tip Top Chicken and Shrimp features the time-tested recipes of seafood and chicken and more. The first Tip Top Chicken and Shrimp is open at 847 Dunn Avenue, just west of I-95. The second will be opening in days at 101 Monument Road, just off Atlantic Boulevard. Tip Top Chicken and Shrimp, the best you've ever tasted. Now at 847 Dunn Avenue and soon at Monument Road.
There has never been a better time to get out on the water on a new Kawasaki or Sea-Doo personal watercraft from Jacksonville Power Sports. Take advantage of the great deals going on right now. With the best selection and the most knowledgeable staff around, Jacksonville Power Sports can set you up with the perfect watercraft at the right price. Drop by the store on Atlantic Boulevard. They're just a half mile west of 295 and check out the huge inventory. Jacksonville Power Sports, your fun starts here. Call 641-5320, online at jacksonvillepowersports.com.
The way the Washington Post did it?
Well, this isn't a court, you know, jury. It's not innocent until proven guilty. We get to draw our own conclusions. No, but apparently we don't get to draw our own conclusions. You either draw the conclusion that the Washington Post wants you to draw, that Mitt Romney wants you to draw, that John McCain wants you to draw, and all the left wants you to draw, or you don't have a right to your own conclusion.
Mark Levin on Talk Radio, AM 600 and 101.1 FM, WBOB. The latest traffic and weather on WBOB, your 2018 election authority.
Only one accident this afternoon. That's good. That's good on a Saturday afternoon. The accident on the I-95 northbound, still in the clearing stages at the exit at Heckscher Drive. Looks like it's on both shoulders there. It could be some onlooker delays. Other than that, you're doing very well. Let's keep up that good work. A severe thunderstorm watch remains in effect until 6. Probably a few scattered showers all we'll get. 74 now in Jacksonville. Talk Radio, WBOB.
Great to have you with us. We're going to go to the Middle East now. Took a lot of time today on Russian collusion in Helsinki and the summit. But now we're going to go to a development in the Middle East that is very riveting. And to break this down for us, joining us now from California, the West Coast, so we had to get up early. We appreciate that. Dr. Christian Ulrichsen. Dr. Ulrichsen is a Baker Institute Fellow for the Middle East. He's worked across the disciplines of political science, international relations, and the international political economy. His Research examines the changing position of Persian Gulf states in the global order, as well as the emergence of long-term non-military challenges to regional security. Previously, Dr. Rickson worked as a senior Gulf analyst at the Gulf Center for Strategic Studies between 2006 and 2008, as co-director of the Kuwait Program on Development, Governance, and Globalization in the Gulf States at the London School of Economics, 2008 to 2013. So you want some information and break things down in the Middle East? We've gone to the expert, Dr. Christian Ulrichsen. Great to have you with us, sir.
Good morning.
Thank you for being up early in California as well. I really appreciate it. I know sometimes it's tough. You got to get up and get a cup of coffee and like, what? What time is this? So thanks for doing that.
A cup of tea.
A cup of tea. That's right. I should know that. A cup of tea. I'm on coffee cup number six. So, you know, back here in the East, we love that Dr. We're flowing, as they say, flowing the Dr. Joe. Dr. Ulrichsen, a new development. This is kind of introversial. This is kind of interesting and controversial. The state of Israel passes a new law yesterday defining the country as a Jewish homeland. The parliament yesterday adopted a law defining, actually today, defining the, because they're 7 hours ahead, defining the country as the nation state of the Jewish people. Now, there's some people say that this is going to lead to extended discrimination against the Palestinian citizens there. And the law defining the country as a Jewish homeland, now this could further marginalize. People don't realize this. There's 1.8 million Palestinians, citizens of Israel. What do you make of this, sir?
Well, I think the decision to make that announcement today was logical, following on from Donald Trump's decision last December to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. It's the Israeli government really trying to keep up the momentum and to perhaps push through some of the policies they've long wanted to try and achieve, and with previous U.S. governments felt they would never have the international backing. And so I think we see here a further move that could create further destabilizing ripple effects across the Middle East, as we've seen with other elements of the current administration's unanticipated consequences of its Middle East policies.
Dr. Ulrichsen, I really find this to be a stunner because it kind of came, we had heard it bubbling up, but a lot of people thought this was going to fail. I did. I'm not close enough to it in the Israel parliament, but it was adopted 62 to 55. It also made Hebrew the country's national language and defines the establishment of Jewish communities, occupying communities, some people would say, right, as being in the national interest. The bill, get this, the bill also strips Arabic of its designation as an official language in the state of Israel, downgrading it to a special status that enables its continued utilization within Israeli institutions. I mean, this is a dramatic piece of legislation passed by the Israeli parliament, really disenfranchising almost 2 million of their citizens. And so what you said is you're tracing it back to the U.S.'s movement of the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Why do you think that was the catalyst for this?
Well, I mean, you're right. It's a fundamental change in the character of Israel, and it goes against decades of initial attempts to integrate all the communities who were living in Israel and in the territory that became Israel in 1948. And so it's clearly a major move. I think we have seen over the past 18 months the tectonic plates in the Middle East really shifting in response to the fact that we do have an administration in Washington, D.C. that's perhaps is more open to taking different policy decisions. And the U.S. does have and continues to hold great sway over developments in the Middle East in both a negative and a positive sense. And so once I think the Israeli government and other governments, the Saudi government, the Emirati government as well, realize that the White House would be a very different place over the next 4 years, they began, I think, to probe and to try to see what policies they could try and push through that clearly would have been quite provocative under any other administration. And so this decision, which really changes the nature of Israel's governing arrangements and perhaps even calls into question the democratic nature of Israel, is perhaps not to be unexpected by the standards of which we're living. It also makes it very interesting now to see whether any of Israel's Arab neighbors in the Middle East will follow through with the Trump administration's attempt to have a peace plan, because Israel has responded now with clearly a move that will be very provocative to many in the Middle East. And so the costs, perhaps, of aligning with a peace plan have gone up quite considerably.
We're with Dr. Christian Coates. Dr. Christian Coates Ulrichsen, he is a Baker Institute Fellow for the Middle East, with us talking about the Israeli situation. Dr. Ulrichsen, I got to ask this question, and then I'm going to get to some of the reactions you're going to expect from some of the Gulf states. But Jared Kushner just made a trip through the Middle East trying to find a way to bring President Abbas of Palestine to the negotiating table. And as you know, and he met with UAE, Saudi, he met with the state of Qatar, he went to Kuwait. And the Saudis are the key to this thing. They have a common enemy, that's Iran. So they have this ultimate deal on the table. But now you look at what, and obviously Jared Kushner had to know this was coming down the pike, right? So now we're at this point where you don't think he knew?
No, I imagine he must have had an inclination.
He had to know.
Yes.
Right, yeah, he had to know.
He may not have been able to put it into context if he doesn't have deep expertise that one might expect of a U.S. negotiator. You know, that would be perhaps something that we would see as a red flag, the lack of negotiating expertise in clearly what has been a flashpoint in Middle East politics for many, many decades.
Yes. So my question is, you've got the Trump plan, which we don't know what it is, right? They don't want to leak it out, but it's called the ultimate plan. But how do you have a plan now? You just disenfranchised 2 million people. You're not going to integrate them. It can't possibly lead to a two-state solution. So where are the Israelis going with this?
Well, yes, it's very difficult to imagine that the plan, whatever that may have been, and as you said, we don't specifically know what the plan actually entailed, has made it much more difficult now to achieve. It's been a deeply provocative move. And perhaps one might think that, as with other Israeli moves in some of the occupied territories, they are just creating facts on the ground, which, irrespective of whether there's a plan or not a plan, leaves Israel in possession of some of the objectives and goals that it's long tried to achieve. And so this may be more about Israel or the Israeli leadership deciding to put into place some desired outcomes without really thinking about whether the plan will work or not. It's putting its own interests first, as, of course, many other nation states would do the same.
Dr. Ulrichsen, would it be fair to conjecture that perhaps the Israelis moved on this now because they didn't think the Trump administration would react as favorably to it? Is that a fair conjecture that I can make?
I imagine so. I mean, I suspect that they have made a move because they felt they could succeed. And, of course, that may not have been an assumption they could have made 2 years ago, or maybe again in another 2 years from now.
So they thought they had a favorable timing, because when you look at this move and the significance of it, basically, I mean, I don't know how else to put this. They're disenfranchising virtually 2 million of their residents. Palestinians living in Israel are just disenfranchised. They downgraded their language. They can't now be a full U.S. citizen based on this without some going through something. So I don't see how you go from there to a peace process. Could you ever see a two-state solution now after this?
Well, it would be very difficult to see that happening if this law is fully implemented and if it continues to be on the books. I mean, of course, there are different segments of the population. The Palestinians in Israel have been steadily more marginalized for the last 20 years. You know, first of their economic rights to work in Israel were steadily eroded, then the occupied territories were effectively sealed off. So, I mean, this is a process that's been taking place for quite some time. There are also the Israeli Arab communities, and they're the ones who I think will feel the full effect of this, because they are Israeli citizens, and of course now they're perhaps complaining that they're second-class Israeli citizens, that you introduce this sort of status within the category of citizenship. So for the Palestinians, it's just formalization of a process that's taken place for almost 20 years since the 2000 Intifada really signaled the end of the 1990s peace attempts. But for the Israeli Arabs, this is something quite disturbing and quite new.
We're with Dr. Christian Ulrichsen. He is a Baker Fellow for the Middle East and a longtime expert in the area. He also attended the London School. He was co-director of the Kuwait Program on Development, Governance, and Globalization in the Gulf States at the London School of Economics. Let me get this straight, from 2008 to 2013. Sir, you have a very long, very impressive resume. I can't get it all out of it. To go over your experience would take my whole show up. So just trust me on this, everybody. This guy really knows what he's talking about. So let's get to the Gulf States. I mean, how are they going to react to this? And let's just run right down. Let's just start with the Saudis. Again, inconceivable to me that Jared Kushner was there a month ago and this topic didn't come up, or Kushner didn't know it was coming up, because if he didn't, then it would be even more shocking to me as he was there. But how are the Saudis going to react to this?
Well, this puts the young Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who was in the U.S. in March and April and who gave speeches to various audiences in the U.S. proclaiming his tacit support for a solution, it puts him in a very difficult position, because Saudi Arabia has always tried to pitch itself as the leader of Islam and the leader of Sunni Islam, and any notion that they're betraying the Palestinians will be felt. And for the crown prince himself, he is not yet the king. He probably would like to become the king of Saudi Arabia very soon, but the king is his father, King Salman. And King Salman has a much more pro-Palestinian orientation than the crown prince. In fact, there are suggestions that the king does not share the crown prince's enthusiasm to make a deal with Jared Kushner, with the Trump administration, and with Israel. And so this announcement is likely to further anger King Salman, who, despite his age, he's 82, still remains in control and has the final say, and could lead to a difference between him and the crown prince, who, of course, has developed close relations with Jared Kushner, and who I think would quite have liked the prospect of being seen as the other half of the deal-making duo on this. So for the Saudis, it puts them in a very difficult position, especially the crown prince.
I agree with that, and especially because he hasn't assumed full power, although he's consolidating it, as you know. And that's another thing where you can say the Trump administration has looked the other way, if you want to put it in those terms rather starkly, his consolidation of power, the arresting of various competitors that under the guise of corruption, that's all come under a question now, staying at the Ritz or whatever they're doing. What about the Emirates? Now, Kushner also met with them. They're normally, how do you think the UAE reacts?
Well, when we talk about the United Arab Emirates, we really mean Abu Dhabi, which is the driving force right now within the UAE. And the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Mohammed bin Zayed, is very close to Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. This new Abu Dhabi-Saudi axis has really tilted the politics of the Gulf in a much more hawkish direction. They've really coordinated on a number of things, including the war in Yemen and the blockade of Qatar. The UAE is in a difficult position, I think, right now in Washington, partly because the Mueller investigation is looking into the attempts they may have made to influence U.S. politics in 2016 and last year. So they've been keeping, I think, a lower profile. That said, the Emirates are also very supportive in private, I think, of the plan that Kushner apparently is making, and the fact that the Saudis, or at least Mohammed bin Salman, also seems to be on board is an indication that the Emirates are also pushing the plan and potentially trying to force any plan that develops onto Palestinians using financial leverage as an inducement and potentially as, you know, as a disincentive to anyone who doesn't want to make a deal. There's a Palestinian strongman called Mohammed Dahlan, who is a former security official who could be the person they try to insert into the occupied territories as the replacement for President Abbas. And Mohammed Dahlan has long been based in Abu Dhabi, and he has a very close relationship with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. So he's a sort of a card that they've been holding to see if they can play it at some point.
So you've got the access going on here between UAE, Abu Dhabi, and the Saudis. And I agree with you, the Abu Dhabi, I think they were the biggest backer of the Kushner plan, no question about it. Let's get to the state of Qatar, then, their reaction. The young emir, who's had to deal with this blockade crisis, which the Qatari government has very successfully maneuvered its way through, and many of them, like me, looking at their economy right now, think they're better off post-blockade than they were pre-blockade, humanitarian issues notwithstanding, Dr. Ulrichsen. So where is the state of Qatar now? Where does the state of Qatar come in this equation?
Well, the Qataris have and are able to leverage relationships they've built up both with the Israelis and in Gaza. They've been active in humanitarian reconstruction in Gaza for several years, and they've been working very closely with the Israelis and the U.S., of course, to coordinate their actions, contrary to some of the Saudi and Emirati accusations against them. So the Qataris can play an important role in trying to diffuse any tensions that this and other announcements may make, because they have those productive working relationships with people on the ground. So I think the Qatari utility right now will be to try and work quietly with the contacts they have to make sure, or at least to try and minimize the fallout from any anger that might have been generated, and to ensure that there's local buy-in, at least a degree of local buy-in to a plan that otherwise could be seen as just being imposed top-down by negotiators who are not even Palestinian. You know, you have Jared Kushner, you have Mohammed bin Salman, you have the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. This is very much an external plan. And if it is a plan, of course, that it would be imposed on the Palestinians. And so to succeed, there would have to be that local support, local buy-in. And the Qataris, having been working on the ground with the Israelis and in Gaza, can play an important role in that respect.
So do you see perhaps their young emir having a really significant seat at this negotiating table and playing a key role, sir?
Well, I think he should do. Of course, if we have the plan being driven by the Crown Princes of Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Abu Dhabi, his two sort of bitter adversaries in the Gulf, that might make it difficult. But if that can be stripped away, then there should be a prominent seat for the Qataris, because unlike the Saudis and Emiratis, who are trying to impose this plan externally and from above, the Qataris have the contacts on the ground on both sides to try and actually build up some grassroots support for it. And that would be important. Right. In fact, it would be essential if this plan is to succeed.
Not to paraphrase, but the understanding of what you're saying, Dr. Oregson, so because of UAE, Abu Dhabi's, and Saudi's already predetermined positions, it's possible that Emir Al-Thani of Qatar could play a very significant role, because they might be looked at as a more objective party. Plus, they have relationships on both sides where that is lacking with Abu Dhabi and the Saudis. So they could actually then play quite a significant role in this, as I understand it. Final question, because I know we're
triangulate that with the U.S. and with Israel. That would be extremely important to try and generate that momentum, that support.
Final question. President Abbas, Palestinian president, did this blindside him, and what is his future now?
Well, I think President Abbas has been in a difficult position for quite some time. He obviously has lost a degree of support and even legitimacy, at least in Gaza. And for many years now, there have been, he's not held elections to the Palestinian Authority for quite some time. And of course, he's getting old. He's in his 80s as well, and apparently not in the best of health. So it could well be that at some point he decides to step down. Of course, then the question becomes who takes over after him. And is it a candidate that's sort of pushed on the Palestinians by the Saudis, the Emiratis, or by Jared Kushner? Because the candidate in that position would really face, I think, a lot of resistance from internally within Palestinian ranks. And of course, then that would make it even more difficult. It might be part of a plan to impose a solution or impose a kind of a settlement, but it wouldn't be a long-term solution. So I think Abbas has been sidelined. I think he'll find it very difficult to convince the Palestinians that he can successfully counter this latest move or successfully resist any external plan imposed by Jared Kushner and others. But then, of course, the alternative might be actually even worse.
All right. Great analysis. I really appreciate you getting up early for us and